Hold on to your hat and grab a towel, because 1 week after Earth Day, the planet, at least on the big screen, will become intergalactic asphalt.
From the celebrated best-selling novel, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
What is this thing?
It's the guide. It's got everything you need to know to survive in the universe. What's up?
Losing your planet isn't the end of the world. It's the beginning of an adventure unlike anything on Earth.
It's this far-out adventure that's earned its creator, the late Douglas Adams, the adoration of millions of fans around the world. The friends of Douglas Adams saw a bit of him in all the characters he wrote into his stories, from the extraordinarily ordinary Arthur Dent to the ultra-hip man about space, Ford Prefect. What many people might not know is that not only did Douglas Adams write for the Monty Python troupe, he was also a conservationist. And underneath all the absurdity of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is an environmental message. Robbie Stamp was a business partner and close friend of Adams for years. He's also executive producer of the much-anticipated movie version of the series. And he joins me now to talk about Douglas Adams' vision for the planet. Robbie Stamp, hello.
Hi there.
So I understand the two of you are great friends. How did you meet?
We met. I was a documentary producer. In fact, an environmental documentary producer. I'd been producing a series of different films on different environmental subjects. And a mutual friend introduced us. And we just got on really well. I mean, from the first time we met, we enjoyed each other's company. And I was lucky enough to go on to both become a close personal friend and start a company with Douglas as well.
Now, before Douglas Adams died, he was working on a screenplay for The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And it finally is going to come now to the big screen. So let's just hear a bit of the trailer here for kicks.
Attention, people of Earth. I regret to inform you that in order to make way for the new Hyperspace Express route, your planet has been scheduled for demolition. Have a nice day.
Hang on, we're hitching a ride.
A galactic superhighway paves over the world. It definitely sounds like an environmental story.
Well, I think there's, I think there were a couple of core strands really that underlay Douglas's worldview. I mean, one was a deeply held wish that humankind, the human species, have a little bit more humility about its place in the grand scheme of things than it seems to, and the other was a deep reverence and awe for the beauties and wonders of, you know, what we do have on this little lump of rock.
So what's the environmental plot then, or perhaps subplot, of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
Well, I mean, it's nice to be doing this interview because I haven't done too many interviews on this subject, and I've always felt it was a subject very, very close to Douglas's heart. I mean, I suppose that if there is an environmental or a conservation subplot in Hitchhikers, and certainly there in the movie, it's that, you know, unusually in a movie of this kind, the Earth gets blown up within the first 9 minutes. I mean, normally people are, you know, racing to save the Earth, and they manage to save it. Well, in this instance, they don't. But what we have at the end of the movie is we have a backup Earth. There is another Earth that's been built by these planet builders, when we discover that in fact the original Earth was a giant computer built to calculate the ultimate question. And we have another Earth, and we get another shot at it. And I think there's something really quite powerful and redemptive about that thought as we see life springing back at the end of the movie. And I think it's very gently done, but it is just a gentle message which says, you know, take care of what we've got because it's fragile and, you know, you can't count on it being here forever.
And what is the answer, by the way, to the ultimate question?
Well, we don't know the ultimate question, but we do. Well, I mean, the answer to life, the universe, and everything was famously 42, which, of course, didn't make a lot of sense. And the computer that calculated that deep thought said, "Well, it would have helped if I knew what the question was," and it is one of the great iconic things about Hitchhikers, 42. I tell you a little story here. For movies, you do a thing called tracking, which is you're keeping a very close eye on how many people want to come and see your movie. And I was talking to the marketing guys yesterday about this, and they said that we've had a very, very high number indeed, which we're really impressed by. We don't normally see numbers quite this good at this stage of a movie, and it's the number of people who say they are definitely going to come and see the movie. And it was 42% of the people that they asked, which I thought was great. And I'd say the tax code that we're using help in to make the movie over here in the UK is Section 42. There's a lot of these 42 coincidences. Poor old Douglas, it was just a joke, but they crop up everywhere.
So Douglas Adams fans, of course, know him for The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and the various books and shows that came as sequels. But he also did this book called Last Chance to See. And I guess despite the topic, which is about endangered species, it certainly has a fair amount of wit in it. And Robbie Stamp, you have a copy of the book with you now, and there are some favorite passages of yours that I'd like you to read to us right now. Could you please?
Yeah, I have. I've chosen these because I think they really sum up for me a lot of what makes Douglas special, not just in terms of the thinking about the endangered species, but what I think was special about his capacity to make us think about things in a different way. And here he is in Africa, and he's having a close encounter with a silverback gorilla in the Virunga Hills. I crept closer to the silverback, slowly and quietly, on my hands and knees, till I was about 18 inches away from him. He glanced around at me unconcernedly, as if I was just someone who'd walked into the room and continued his contemplations. As I moved again, he shifted himself away from me, just about 6 inches, as if I'd sat slightly too close to him on a sofa, and he was grumpily making a bit more room. Then he lay on his front, with his chin on his fist, idly scratching his cheek with his other hand. I sat as quiet and still as I could, despite discovering that I was being bitten to death by ants. After a quiet interval had passed, I carefully pulled the pink writing paper out of my bag and started to make the notes that I'm writing from at the moment. This seemed to interest him a little more. I suppose he'd simply never seen pink writing paper before. His eyes followed as my hand squiggled across the paper, and after a while he reached out and touched first the paper and then the top of my ballpoint pen, not to take it away from me or even to interrupt me, just to see what it was and what it felt like. I felt very moved by this and had a foolish impulse to want to show him my camera as well. He retreated a little and lay down again about 4 feet from me with his fist once more propped under his chin. The most disconcerting intelligence seemed to be apparent from the sidelong glances he would give me, prompted not by any particular move I'd made, but apparently by a thought that had struck him. I began to feel how patronising it was of us to presume to judge their intelligence, as if ours was any kind of standard by which to measure. I tried to imagine instead how he saw us, but of course that's almost impossible to do, because the assumptions you end up making as you try to bridge the imaginative gap are, of course, your own. And the most misleading assumptions are the ones you don't even know you're making. But somehow, in the genetic history that we each carry with us in every cell of our body, was a deep connection with this creature, as inaccessible to us now as last year's dreams, but, like last year's dreams, always invisibly and unfathomably present.
Why did you pick that?
Well, I picked that because, I know from talking to Douglas that he always described that encounter with the silverback gorilla as one of the most amazing moments of his life, but also because I think it sums up a lot of what makes him special intellectually. I mean, his writing, that phrase, actually, that he talks about, the imaginative gap and the most misleading assumptions are the ones you don't even know you're making. I think that Douglas was a great one for giving us different mental models for thinking of the world. I talked earlier about his desire that we should all have a little bit more humility. One of the great images I remember him using quite frequently when he spoke was of a puddle. And he says, a puddle wakes up one morning and it looks around at the hole in which it is. And it thinks, gosh, this hole fits me very nicely. In fact, this hole must have been made just specially for me. And it continues to think so as the sun comes out and dries it up. And I think Douglas felt a little bit the same about, you know, our worldview, where we look around at, you know, the world that seems to fit us and thinks, gosh, well, this has been made just specially for us, hasn't it? And I think that way of challenging assumptions, making us think again about things, and I think that's something that runs absolutely through Hitchhikers.
Now, we were able to find some old recordings of Douglas Adams himself reading from this book, Last Chance to See. And, you know, as with movies themselves, sometimes the outtakes are funnier than the actual cut that gets shown to the public. So let's take a listen.
Now, you may think that I've managed to read this book very, very impressively, perfectly, without any errors, all the way through. I have to tell you, this is by no means the case. And here, for your amusement, is a compilation of some of the things we missed out. That's actually the reason I'm having difficulty is a badly written sentence. And they get terribly upset if they hear words they don't understand the meaning of. They think it's all a communist plot. Never mind. Fuck it. Ah! Better! Oh, Was I swallow something else? Was discovered in a fuck. One black rhino in Kenya caught me off guard once and severely dented a car's friend.
Rob, well, there we go. That's a very fine set of outtakes.
Now, Robbie Stamp, is this what you would call rather normal behaviour for this famous
Ooh,
author?
Oh, I recognise Douglas. It's always lovely to hear his voice, and I certainly recognise Douglas in that, the humour and the wit and the language. No, I certainly recognise Douglas there.
Speaking of hijinks, his hijinks, I understand there was an incident in a rhino costume.
Yeah, I mean, Douglas was a patron of the Dian Fossey Gorilla Fund and Save the Rhino International. And he went on a sponsored walk wearing a rhino costume in Kenya. I don't know sort of whether he did any of the really steep bits of Mount Kilimanjaro, but he certainly walked along the road in great heat wearing a rhino costume. I mean, you know, he put himself... I mean, he was a big man, 6'5". It was hot. I mean, this was very definitely going the extra mile.
Robbie Stamp was a co-founder with Douglas Adams of the production company Digital Village. He's also executive producer of the new movie Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And I suppose I should say, so long and thanks for the fish.
Well, thanks very much for having me. I really hope we've done Douglas proud.